is the fact that you go through all of these calculations, and at the end of the day, you've got no idea what you've actually calculated. Because one of the things about general relativity is it sort of cuts almost all the ground out from under you. One's used to having, for example, a space-time and knowing where one is, laying out a coordinate system, and then you can talk about particles traveling with respect to that coordinate system. Distances from the walls, for example, in this room. And when I say the particle is at position 7, or 7, 3, 2, for the various components, you sort of feel you know what that means physically, because you can measure those distances from the wall. And the problem in general relativity, of course, is that you suddenly learn that you can do physics where these coordinates are completely up to you. You just label points in space-time, whatever that means. It's not clear what you're hanging these labels on, because points in space-time are something that doesn't really seem to exist. So you sort of arbitrarily label these points, and then you start doing calculations. And the whole machinery of tensor calculus allows you to say, all right, if I do it in this coordinate system, then I can transform over to this other coordinate system very easily. That, of course, doesn't help very much if you have got no idea what in the world any of these coordinate systems mean, which is where you're usually left with. Sometimes in situations with high symmetry, for example, spherical symmetry, one can use that symmetry and say, okay, well, I'm going to take this point, I rotate it, and I get this whole sphere of points that it rotates into. That sort of means something, but that means something only if you happen to have spherical symmetry. And virtually nothing, as we know in life, is spherically symmetric. So you can solve the equations and think you know what they mean. You can now define the radial coordinate, for example, by saying, okay, the radial coordinate is going to be the circumference divided by 2 pi of these spheres. It's not the distance to the center of those spheres, because I don't know where the center is or even if it has a center. But I can measure the circumference and divide that by 2 pi and define that as being a sort of a radius. In general, one can't do that. So one of the things that being trained in that kind of a field does for you, and in particular if you happen to be trained by somebody like John Wheeler, is to constantly think about what could I measure? How could I make a measurement on this system to try and get the physical quantities? Because after all, measurements are something that, you know, the numbers you get out of measurements is surely physical. The numbers you get out of these coordinates, who knows what they mean, because they're all over the place. But, you know, if I do it physically, then it should mean something. Often, that turns out to be really hard to do. And you fudge things. For example, in spherical symmetry, one almost never asks, you know, I don't know if you've done the bending of light. How in the world do you set up that whole bending of light experiment in such a way that it's going to be independent of these coordinates? One of the things you can always do is to actually look at the experiments that people did, running out there with photographic plates, taking photographs of the Pleiades, and then 6 months later, actually they did it the other way around, but anyway, 6 months later you come back when there's a solar eclipse right in that area. You take the same picture of those Pleiades, and now you measure the distances between the stars on your photographic film and see whether or not they fit. And you find that, lo and behold, the stars all do seem to have moved away from that center because of the bending of light. So one can try and analyze it that way, but one of the things it does is it trains you very strongly to constantly be thinking about what's the physics. Not just what's the mathematics, but what's the physics. One of the great and horrible things about physics is that there's these two strains in there. There's the mathematical strain, which really disciplines your mind, disciplines what you can do because you want to do things properly mathematically. And then there's the other strain, which is, what's the physics and how does the physics and the mathematics fit together? And it's often hard to figure that out. But one of the things this thing led to was when I started thinking about particles and asking myself, what's a particle? We know in 20th century physics, because of special relativity, it's ironic because Einstein was a very, very strong particleist. He believed the world was made up of particles, and that was one of the things that led him to the photoelectric effect and regarding light as being particles. Unfortunately, because of quantum field, special relativity, it turns out that particle physics is just inconsistent. You can't set up interactions between these particles except point interactions where they collide with each other, and we're interested in more things than that. And over the first 30 years or 40 years of this century, it gradually dawned on people that the only consistent physics was field theory. Fortunately, one had an example of this, namely the electromagnetic field, which was special relativistically invariant and guided Einstein towards special relativity. But the realization came that you had to cast all of physics in that form. So, you know, protons or electrons are no longer these little particles that go running around. They're this quantum field that obeys the Dirac equation. Protons may be simple or they may be composite objects, but anything that you have, whether it's the quark field or these protons or electrons or mesons or whatever, aren't particles. They really are described in all of our theories, you know, grand unified theories, etc., as field theories. You've got this field, which is something that exists at every point in space at all times, which is the opposite of a particle, which has a specific location, and that location changes from time to time. Fields are everywhere all the time. They just have different values at different places. So one of the questions that came up is, what is a particle? Particle theorists had sort of fudged their way through this and said, look, I can go ahead and decompose these fields into modes. So there are certain solutions for the equations of motions of the field. For example, if you have something like a scalar field, which obeys an equation, let's say, like dt squared. Have you seen this notation? Physicists are really lazy. They don't like to write more than they absolutely have to. Minus dx squared minus dy squared, etc. Phi equals zero. Well, we know solutions of these go as, you know, e to the I omega t minus k dot x. Phi is looking like that are solutions to those equations. And in fact, there's a certain sense in which all of these equations are also orthogonal to each other. So one can always expand any solution to the field equations, these free field equations, in terms of these so-called modes. And when one looks at the quantum mechanics of those modes, they look just like ordinary harmonic oscillators. They had learned from Heisenberg and so forth how to solve the harmonic oscillator in terms of annihilation and creation operators. You've all, or the raising and lowering operators, the A's and A daggers. Well, those were then the particles. If you had a mode and that had an associated A's and A daggers with them, the ground state of that is the thing that's annihilated by the annihilation operators. And particle states were then things, for example, a single particle state which is a single particle in this mode, would be a state that looks like this. It's a very mathematical definition. And in fact, you start wondering where in the world the physics is in this. The problem was when one came to curved space-time and one tried to go through the same thing, you found you ran into trouble. That which modes you should choose, which frequencies you should choose to associate with the A's and A daggers, became completely uncertain. So what in the world a particle was within this theory, again, itself became completely uncertain. People trying to follow their sort of mathematical intuition looked to do the same kind of thing as you did in flat space-time, and you just got ambiguous results. Hawking, for example, followed his nose in this and discovered that black holes evaporated. Well, if you looked at the radiation far away where you were in flat space, well, then you felt you could do the same thing as you had learned back in the 30s and 40s and 50s and had some faith in it. But the question I asked myself is, what's going on near the black hole? Where are these particles being created near the black hole? How can I describe the physics when you're near the black hole, when I don't have a good definition, this kind of a mathematical definition, for what a particle is? So the one thing that being with John Wheeler had taught me very well is to always ask physical questions. Don't just be happy with following the mathematics. Ask where the physics is. So, if I'm going to ask where the particles are, I have to ask myself, what do I mean by a particle? If I've got a field theory. So really, you know, electromagnetic field or whatever, I've got this field, I want to ask, what are the particles that are associated with the field? How would I know I had a particle? Well, if I go out and ask an experimentalist, he'll rummage through his equipment and come up with something like a Geiger counter and say, here's a Geiger counter. I hold it up, it clicks, I've got a particle. That's what a particle is. And I said to myself, okay, let's define particles that way. A particle is something that a particle detector detects. Well, I mean, it sounds a little tautological. On the other hand, it sort of causes one to think in a different way about these things. That a particle is something that arises out of a certain way of interacting with the field, of trying to understand what's going on in the field by doing an actual experiment. So I can imagine building a sort of little model particle detector. For example, I can imagine I've got a little two-level system, different energies. I've got some field out here, and I can take the simplest one, the scalar field, but if you want, I could take the electromagnetic field as well. And somehow I want a coupling between this system and the scalar field, and the detection process is going to be in the coupling between this and the scalar field, I suddenly find this detector has gone from the ground state to an excited state. Well, how could it have gotten there? The only way it could have gotten there is if this detector had absorbed a particle of the field. If the field is in its vacuum state, is in its ground state, that's its lowest energy state, then the field couldn't give any energy to the detector and couldn't cause the detector to be excited. So this detector has to have been in an excited state, a single particle state or something, in order to excite this detector. When you make a model like this, so you set up a little two-level system in flat space, and you, for example, now go ahead and talk to the particle physicists and they tell you, okay, here's a one particle or a two particle state. you stick this thing into the, as a little model, into that state for the scalar field, a one or two particle or whatever detector, and lo and behold, you find that this has a certain probability of being excited. That probability of being excited turns out to depend on what the value of the mode is at the location of the detector. So if X is the location of the detector, it's the value of the solution. That's one of the modes, let's say a plane wave mode, but you can use any kinds of modes that you wanted to. The value of the mode at the position, well, that sounds right. If this thing is going to have a single particle in it, surely the detection is going to depend on how much is there, where the detector is. If this completely always misses the detector, you're going to get zero excitation. That sounds right. And then it turns out that the detection probability will also depend on exactly how many of these particles one has in the state. What is it, square root of n factorial or something like that. So each one of these represents a particle. The probability of this particle detector when you go through the calculation depends on how many particles there are in this particular mode. That sounds right as well. So this particle detector seems to be behaving the way you expect it to. Behaves like a Geiger counter. If you hold the Geiger counter here, if the excitation comes through the Geiger counter, it's got some probability of exciting it. If it doesn't, it doesn't. And it depends on how many particles come through to excite it. But the advantage of this is that you can now take this thing that you have some confidence really acts like a particle detector and put it into unusual situations. And the first unusual situation that I thought of putting it into, which was the situation that had to do with where these particles around a black hole, was what happens if I accelerate this particle detector? So I've got this little particle detector that I'm now sure behaves the right way in situations that I understand, and now I do something funny to it. I accelerate it. Why would I accelerate it? Well, if you're very close to a black hole, to stand just outside a black hole, I've got to be accelerated. So there seems to be some relationship between them. So I can now do the calculation. I can take this little two-level system. I can place it on an accelerated trajectory. So this x is now going to be a function of time. Well, let's make it a function of the proper time. Along the trajectory. And I can now ask, how is the particle detector going to respond if I place it onto this accelerated trajectory? For example, I could have t equals, what's a good one, something like sinh a tau. I guess there's a 1 over a out here, where a is the acceleration. And z equals 1 over a cosh a tau. This in special relativity is simply a uniformly accelerated path. So at all points along this path, it turns out that the absolute value of the acceleration, if we take the four velocity of the four vector corresponding to the acceleration, it has constant length. So this is a constantly accelerated particle. I can now interact it with the field, and let's say I put the field in the vacuum state. And you say, well, that's a silly thing to do. We know how the particle detector behaves if there are no particles around. But it didn't. When you do that, when you place this particle detector into this accelerated trajectory, and you put the field phi into its vacuum state, its lowest energy state, you find that there's a finite probability of excitation of that particle detector. Furthermore, that finite probability has a thermal factor sitting out front of it. And in fact, it behaves exactly as though you had placed this detector into a thermal bath. Unaccelerated, you take that unaccelerated detector, you put it into a thermal bath, it's going to start clicking. This accelerated detector, placed into the vacuum state, starts clicking in exactly the same way. What does that mean? Well, you've got two choices. You can say, well, look, this, you know, you had this story about particle detectors. I guess that was just a silly story, so let's just forget about it. That's, of course, not the route I took. That's boring. The other possibility is to take seriously the statement that a particle is what a particle detector detects. I've now designed a particle detector that behaves in the right way in all the situations that I know of. I now put it in this new unusual situation, and it starts telling me that there are particles there. Why don't I believe it? And the answer, I think, is that yes, you really can regard this accelerated state as though it were filled with particles, a thermal bath of particles. So that, so we've got our little detector here. It has these two levels. Those two levels could, of course, be just part of a whole bunch of levels that it could have, and we're just looking at these particular two levels. Ask what's the excitation probability, and we get thermal state. Further calculations show that if you let this thing sit there for a long time, it will come into thermal equilibrium with the bath, just as you would expect if it were really in contact with a thermal state. Bob Wald and I, that was a really funny story because there was this huge debate about black holes and whether black holes were really thermodynamic objects. I know some of you went to my talk. Black holes emit thermal radiation. They look like thermodynamic objects as if they have energy, temperature, entropy. But are they really? Can you run heat engines with them? And Jacob Bekenstein had designed this heat engine where he had a box full of radiation. Some guy pushing on this handle and lowering the box down towards this black hole. Well, as this box goes down, there's a tension in the rope. That tension does work. So you're converting this radiation in the box into useful work. That's a heat engine. So you fill this box with radiation. You now lower it down to the black hole. And now you open the box. And the radiation all escapes and goes into the black hole, increasing the size of the black hole. Well, if you lower it really close to the black hole, you can in fact extract all of the work, all of the energy in this radiation as work. So the amount of energy that goes into the black hole is zero, so the black hole doesn't change. And you've just managed to convert all of the radiation to useful work. But if the black hole has got its own temperature, that violates the second law of thermodynamics. You're not supposed to be able to convert all radiation to useful work. What goes wrong? Jacob Bekenstein was the original one that came up with this. Well, actually, it was Bob Garoche. But Jacob Bekenstein worried about this a lot, and he thought there must be a new law of physics which prevents this from happening. A law of physics which says that there's the entropy to energy ratio of the system is limited by the size of the box. And doing that, he could wave his hands and argue that then the second law wouldn't be obeyed. I was really uncomfortable about this. One shouldn't have to produce new laws of physics in order to save, let's say, the second law of thermodynamics. What was forgotten here? Well, what was forgotten was when this box is very near the horizon of the black hole, it's accelerated. An accelerated box acts as though it's in a thermal bath. Furthermore, as we all know from our elevator rides, if you're accelerated upwards, you also feel as though you're in a gravitational field. And so Bob Wald and I went through the literature and we found this preprint from about 400 BC by a guy by the name of Archimedes in a book called On Floating Bodies, where he told us that, you know, if you stick a body into a fluid in a gravitational field, well, he was talking about the Earth, so he didn't really mention the gravitational field, but it was there, that it would feel a buoyant force proportional to the weight of the box. This box sees a thermal fluid surrounding itself because of its acceleration. That thermal fluid then provides a buoyant force on the box. The closer the box comes to the horizon, the higher the acceleration, the higher the density of this fluid, the more buoyant force there is. Well, what does that buoyant force do? It decreases the tension in the rope. So you don't extract all of the energy by lowering it down. Some of that energy, some of that tension isn't there in the rope, because of the buoyant force of the box. And when you go through the calculation, you find that that's exactly what you need in order to satisfy the second law of thermodynamics. So black holes obey the second law of thermodynamics, not because you have to invent some brand new physics, but because an accelerated object really feels that there's this thermal bath surrounding it that behaves like any other thermal fluid, which can hold it up and save the second law of thermodynamics. Bob and I got together, and I had just been at a conference talking to Kip Thorne and Freeman Dyson happened to be at the conference, and I was chatting to them. And Freeman Dyson asked me, you know, what about this law, you know, second law and lowering boxes into black hole? He'd worried about it a bit, couldn't figure it out. And for some reason, just as he said that, I said, well, it must be because of the buoyant force of the radiation. I came home. 2 days later, Bob Wald was coming to visit me, and he said, Bill, I've got something really interesting to talk to you about. And I said, oh, I've got something interesting to talk to you about. And he said, it's about boxes and black holes. And I said, that's what I want to talk to you about. The buoyant force of the acceleration radiation holds. Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So we spent about the next 4 days wandering the hills above Vancouver, trying to get the details down right, doing the calculation properly. It turned out we'd actually made a small mistake, which I corrected with a student about 5 years later, when Nathan Myhrvold. You probably know him as the second in command at Microsoft for many years under Bill Gates. He was their sort of technology, the top scientific officer at Microsoft. He went there after he was doing physics. He had pointed out this problem in our proof, and I and a student finally managed to fix it up. So, you know, it didn't quite gel together, but almost did. So the main thing that I wanted to talk to you about, what I wanted to tell you, is if you get confused in physics, think about physics. Thinking about mathematics is important. I mean, mathematics is incredibly useful because it allows you to think without thinking. Because you develop this technology, you know, you learn how to differentiate, you learn how to integrate, you learn how to solve differential equations. There's all this technology, which can in fact be packaged into packages like Maple or Mathematica, so that even a stupid computer can do them. But there's all this technology that allows you to go from point A to point B without ever having to think along the way. Because the technology just takes you from one step to the next. And it's incredibly important to do that. Because it's so, so easy for us to think ourselves into mistakes. You know, that you don't follow the mathematics and you suddenly find that your logic has led you astray. It's very easy to do. The problem is very often we come to rely on that. And one of the lessons I hope I'm glad I was trying to teach you is the other thing you have to do is to constantly think about the physics. What am I actually calculating? What do these calculations mean? If I were to do an experiment to measure whatever this effect is, how would I do the experiment? How would I bring the experiment into the calculation so that I could understand the outcome of the experiment in conjunction with the calculation? You know, don't just calculate. That's extremely important to calculate, but don't just calculate. Constantly ask yourself physical questions about your calculation so that you understand what the calculation really means physically as well as logically and mathematically. I think I've burbled on long enough at this point. I've no idea what these meetings are supposed to be all about. And you probably don't know either. So why don't I, at this point, open it up to questions? Yes?
You said that an accelerated frame, then in zero, you see it looks like a thermal bath when you accelerate.
Right.
I think it's the holographic principle that takes a black hole and on the surface of the space, it also looks like a thermal field. Is that related somehow?
It may be. I mean, so the string theorists have gone in a certain direction, very much led by their mathematics. And I've always had some trouble trying to figure out what the physics in there is. And I think that's one of the things that they're really working on is how to put physics into the whole holographic idea. In a sense, part of that originated from this Jacob Bekenstein arguments. He was sort of one of the fathers of this holographic principle, getting these entropy to energy ratios and so forth. They make me feel nervous. So I don't know, I'm certainly the wrong person to ask about the holographic principle because I don't understand it. And one of the key things that, one of my key problems in there is what are the physical questions that are being answered? Now, to some extent, the mathematics is hard enough that that's not obvious. You know, our technology isn't good enough that we can chase the calculations far enough that we can really start asking physical questions about the theory. But I think that's one of the things that has to be constantly kept in mind in thinking about the theory. I mean, the mathematics is a lot of fun, and there have been some absolutely incredible mathematics developed along the way, which is good. But ultimately, one has to get back into physics, and a number of them are trying to. A number of them are trying to find ways of applying the ideas so that one can extract physics from them. So the short answer is, I don't know.
What's the actual relationship between Hawking radiation and Unruh radiation? Because we've sort of seen them both derive from each other almost, yet they seem to display different properties in terms of like energy transport. if you're outside a black hole, would you just see Hawking radiation, or would you see sort of both, or are they equivalent?
Well, to go back to, they're certainly not equivalent. If you look at the derivation, they were derived in very different contexts. The acceleration radiation was derived from looking at accelerated detectors in flat spacetime. No black holes, no nothing like that around. But it's clear from this argument that there seems to be a very close relationship to them. That in order for thermodynamics for black holes to make sense, which was derived in a sense from the Hawking radiation arguments, that there is this thermal radiation coming off of the system, which makes it look like a thermodynamic object, in order for that to fit together, you have to also have the acceleration radiation. That the one is necessary to make the other one consistent. So there seems to be a very close relationship. Furthermore, if you look at this box, or if you have an observer or whatever, far away from the black hole, bigger than, let us say, 3m. 2m is the Schwarzschild radius, 3m is 50% bigger. If you're further out than that, you basically see this radiation coming from a black hole as if it were a black body, as if it were a hot body. And that's independent of your acceleration. In particular, when you get far enough away from it, you have virtually no acceleration. And you still see this radiation. It's peculiar because it's coming from just one place, namely the black hole is there and it's hot. And over there, everything is still cold. So it's non-equilibrium, but it's radiation coming out. As you get closer and closer, that just seems to smoothly transition over into where the radiation now seems to cover the whole sky. You seem to be enveloped in this more or less universal thermal bath. Maybe at very high frequencies right behind you, away from the black hole, you see this little dark hole where there isn't as much radiation. And if you do the calculations, that temperature that you see surrounding yourself is just proportional to your acceleration. So the one seems to go smoothly over to the other as you come closer and closer to the horizon of the black hole. So although, you know, in their derivation, etc., the two are very different from each other. I mean, Hawking certainly didn't do anything with particle detectors or anything like that. He just sort of took the mathematician's definition of particles far away in flat space-time and said, okay, there seems to be this thermal radiation coming out of the system. But you get close, and suddenly the one seems to morph over into the other. That also tells you that if you get close to the horizon, and instead of being accelerated, you keep yourself out, let's say you just let yourself fall. Well, now you're acting like a freely falling observer in flat space-time. And what does that act like? Well, the state acts as though it were the vacuum state. There's nothing there. The particle detector wouldn't see anything. Well, it would see a little bit because the gravitational field keeps changing as you fall into the black hole. But you certainly don't see any thermal radiation. So this would also predict that, yes, if you're accelerated near the horizon of a black hole, you see this acceleration radiation, which just smoothly goes over into the Hawking radiation. If you're freely falling far from the black hole, you just still just see the Hawking radiation. If you're freely falling right near the horizon, you basically see almost nothing. So the question I asked myself originally is one I really still haven't answered. You know, it's only been 30 years, so. The high temperature, I mean, superconductor people, they've had 100 years and they still don't understand the phenomenon, so this has only been 35 years, so. Where was I? The original question is, where were those particles being created? What's going on right near the black hole? Is one that I still haven't entirely answered. You know, I'd like to have a nice, simple story which showed how these, whatever particle creation was going on there, how that actually happens. But what the story makes clear is that the question, in a sense, may be the wrong question, because we're not doing particle physics, we're doing quantum field theory. And in quantum field theory, particles are a derived concept. Particles are the things that particle detectors detect. They're not something inherent to the theory. You know, in many situations, it's useful to think of them that way, but they're not something that's really inherent in the theory. So we should be thinking of the theory in terms of a quantum field theory, and perhaps that would give us more insight. Unfortunately, it hasn't given me much extra insight yet, but we're working on it.
To clear, so when you're close to a black hole, the Unner effect is enough alone to describe what you're seeing.
Right.
But further away, it's not. Why do we need to invoke Hawking? What's the discontinuity there?
So what you get, what you find is that near the black hole,
because you're still accelerating when you're a finite distance away, so why?
Right, but that acceleration falls off as 1/r².
But doesn't the Hawking radiation redshift? Doesn't the Hawking radiation redshift the same amount, or not?
No. So the Hawking radiation, as you get away, goes to a finite temperature. What happens there is that the angle of the sky that gets covered drops off as 1/r². Right? The size of the black hole gets smaller and smaller as you get farther and farther away from it. So that's what happens, but the actual spectrum of the radiation from that small patch of sky just goes to a constant temperature, which is that 1/m.
So at some finite distance away, you would see that constant temperature and whatever temperature you're accelerating with?
Well, the trouble is the acceleration temperature has become so low that it becomes irrelevant. Becomes much less than this radiation that's coming from that area of the sky.
Thanks.
They really do sort of smoothly, one smoothly goes over into the other one. And around, it's around 3m. 3m is where, if you look, particles closer than 3m tend to go out of the black hole and then fall back in. Farther away than 3m, particles just tend to miss it, except for a few of them. And similarly, a few of these inside get out. So that seems to be roughly the borderline between the two descriptions. But obviously, it's not a sharp and fast boundary. It's just, you know, nice smooth function, one going over into the other one. Yes?
So you have sort of created this...
Sorry, speak up.
Sorry. You have created this sort of measuring device for particles, and then you thought about that, you created, then you were put in an accelerated frame, and I imagine that for a while you stop thinking, you do the computation, and you get the result that it started clicking.
Right.
And what do you think is going on? Why does it start clicking? Or what is physics of that? Or is it just the way the world it is, and that's, you have just to accept it as a fact?
This is, of course, the next physics question, which is the harder one. I can make up a sort of story that goes something like this. Let's think about my two-level detector, this little box. And out here I've got a bunch of vacuum fluctuations. What does that mean? If I were to measure this field on a very short time scale, I would find that the value of the field had all kinds of different values. And in fact, every one of these, this is true for every one of the modes of this field. Now, this detector only really gets excited by certain very specific frequencies. Those frequencies that correspond, h-bar times the frequency is that energy difference. So I've got some mode here which has some fluctuation in it. It comes along and if for a short instant of time, it can, it will excite this detector. Now usually what happens is that that mode keeps coming along and then it de-excites the detector. so that on average the detector just stays down at the bottom. And the longer you wait, the more it's firmly anchored it's at the bottom. But over these short periods of time, it can get excited. But if I accelerate this box, by the time that second part of the mode comes along that was supposed to de-excite it, this is moving at the wrong speed. It Doppler shifts, and it can no longer de-excite it. It's got the wrong frequency to de-excite it. Now this next mode comes along and sort of excites it, but it's now just a completely random process, and it's like a drunken, you know, random walk. It eventually walks its way away from zero, and that's the probability of exciting this detector. So you can make up a sort of little physical story like this, which makes it not totally unreasonable that that detector will get excited. That story, of course, doesn't tell you how much it gets excited, etc. It does suggest that the excitation drops off at high frequencies, because obviously at very high frequencies, this hasn't had a chance to accelerate much during one period, and so the next bit of it does de-excite it. And you know, for a thermal distribution, it drops off exponentially with frequency. So it sort of fits together to give you a little story. But I mean, that also illustrates the tremendous advantage of having a mathematical theory, because you can get results that you don't really completely understand just from hand-waving arguments, just from sort of physical arguments. Yes?
What is this experiment status of radiation?
It's hard to measure. So an acceleration of, 10 to the 23rd centimeters per second squared is 1 degree Kelvin. So that's tough. Now, Bell and Linnaeus, this is J.S. Bell of Bell's inequality, he was a particle physicist in his real job, and all this stuff with quantum mechanics and interpretation of quantum mechanics was a little sidelight that he, in fact, felt he was not paid for, and so he shouldn't even be working on it. And some of the work he did was when he had a sabbatical 1 year, and so felt he could indulge himself in these pastimes. Anyway, but in his particle physics, with his particle physics hat, he got involved with, I think it was a postdoc of his Linnaeus, who's now in Norway. And they looked at an electron, let us say, in a synchrotron, a storage ring. Now those guys sit there for a long time. One of the big problems about this acceleration radiation is that you've got to accelerate it for a long time for it to come into thermal equilibrium. So if you imagine the linear accelerator, like Stanford's linear accelerator, it would have to be roughly the diameter of Jupiter's orbit or something for, you know, a constant acceleration of that electron, by which time its gamma factor is incredibly high, in order to have a reasonable probability of the thing having approached thermal equilibrium. Well, in a storage ring, you can let the thing sit there for hours. You know, and a light hour is a long distance. That is all when you're getting towards the distance to Jupiter. And it's obviously accelerated. It's not linearly accelerated, but it's radially accelerated. The acceleration keeps changing direction. And what that means is that it turns out that the temperature is not quite a uniform temperature. It's not a single temperature, but the temperature has a slight frequency dependence, about 20%. So the effective temperature at low frequencies is about 20% less than it is at high frequencies. But so in these storage rings, you've got a magnetic field which curves the electron around in a circle. That magnetic field also splits the spin levels of the electron. Up and down spin have different levels, so that can act as a thermometer. And they calculated what would be the depolarization of the electron. due to this effect, and they got a figure like about 90, you could polarize it to a maximum value of about 95%. After that, you'd go into thermal equilibrium, and you couldn't polarize it more than that. That's probably the closest place in which one can argue that one might be able to see the effect. The trouble is there are other depolarization effects as well, inhomogeneities in the magnetic field, etc. But that's probably the closest place where one can imagine measuring this acceleration radiation. It turns out also to be more complicated. J.D. Jackson, you all know him from his book, Electrodynamics. How many of you have never heard of J.D. Jackson's Electrodynamics? That's small. Okay. You're missing some. That's a great book. But anyway, he has said that he hates the book because all anybody ever remembers him for is that stupid book, rather than the physics he did. He's a very good physicist. He's a very good physicist who did not get tenure at McGill because who knows why. But he didn't believe that the circular argument had anything to do with acceleration radiation. And so I went off and did the Bell and Linnaeus calculation again in some detail and showed that there's an extra effect. It turns out that there's actually two thermometers here. One is the spin, and the other one is it's like a harmonic oscillator in the Z direction. The particle can bob up and down and is circulating this way, but it can also sort of bob up and down in the Z direction. That's also heated up by this acceleration radiation. But that bobbing up and down can also depolarize the spin via the Thomas precession. You know, if you've got an acceleration on a spin, that can change the spin axis. So this can basically do a depolarization. Those two interfere. And just about for an electron, some of those interference effects are maximal. So it's a more complicated situation than you would really like, but it really does seem that's probably the best place where one can look for measurements of the acceleration radiation. Whether or not it's been seen already, I'm not sure. I'm not an experimentalist. Oops, sorry, yeah, I guess I am now. But I'm still 150 years out of date. I just do these experiments with water, not particle accelerators. Yes?
Yeah, I was just wondering, because you said that you can see all kinds of particles if you're accelerating. Do you mean that you can see photons or all kinds of?
Anything. So you see a certain temperature. And you basically, the world around you looks as though it's in thermal equilibrium at that temperature. So if the temperature is high enough to produce electron-positron pairs, you'll see yourself surrounded by electron-positron pairs as well as photons, as well as pi mesons, as well as whatever else can be excited at those temperatures. So it really is like a thermal soup.
So basically, if you had a machine that could accelerate you, like, how much you ever liked, you could see the whole spectrum of all kinds of particles very consistent.
Yep. Okay. You would really, you know, be like you were in the initial stages of the universe, where you know, the very high temperature initial stages of the universe, where you're surrounded by the soup of all the possible kinds of particles that you could have around you. Now, of course, you would have to be sensitive enough to be able to see them. I mean, for example, we're bathed with quite a bath of neutrinos right now, but our detection efficiency for neutrinos is horrible. So we don't see all of these neutrinos. We see mainly electromagnetic radiation. There's an interesting fact, by the way, that if you were in orbit around a star that went supernova, you would not be killed by the blast wave of the supernova, you'd be killed by the neutrinos. Even though your cross section is so small, so many neutrinos get formed in one of those supernova collapses, and they escape first before anything else does, that you would get cooked by them before you would get cooked by all the other stuff that went on in the supernova. I mean, it doesn't make very much difference, maybe 5 minutes, but that's definitely inside. Yes.
So you were talking about a buoyant force, and I was just wondering if I, you know, if I started accelerating, and would I actually start feeling like an extra force that I couldn't account for by like my rockets or whatever?
Yeah.
What direction would it be in?
Well, the thing is, remember that to get a buoyant force, the thing has to displace the fluid. If it's transparent to the fluid, then of course the fluid just goes and you won't feel a buoyant force. So you have to have walls that are going to exclude the outside fluid in order to feel that buoyant force.
Okay.
Now you might ask, okay, let's keep accelerating. This buoyant force gets higher and higher. Surely, eventually, it's going to be equal to the force just necessary to accelerate me. So I don't need any external thing to accelerate me. I'm just going to get accelerated by the buoyant force.
So it's in the same direction as...
Yeah. And the answer is, in principle, yes. So you could actually have this self-sustaining acceleration where you're just accelerating on the buoyant force that's there because of your acceleration. Now, if you accelerate it even a little bit more than that, then the buoyant force is bigger than needed to accelerate you, and you keep your acceleration keeps building up and up. It turns out, however, that in order to do that, you need walls of this box such that the velocity of sound in those walls is much, much higher than C. So it's probably not possible to build such a box. But it's a fun thing to think about, having this sort of self-sustaining acceleration where nothing is pushing you except your own, I mean, it's your own acceleration that's pushing you. If you look at it from the point of view of a non-accelerated observer, of course, he says, what are you talking about, a thermal bath? There's no, we're in the vacuum state. There's no thermal bath. What he sees instead is that as your acceleration increased, you radiated radiation, which decreased your mass. And when you get to the self-accelerated stage, you've in fact emitted so much radiation that you've lost all of your energy. You're a zero energy particle, and of course a zero energy particle doesn't need any force to accelerate it. So it's consistent. Weird, but it's consistent. Yes?
Speaking of the direction thing, I've heard about this like apparent event horizon you can associate with under irradiation.
There's a what?
Is there an apparent event horizon that you can associate with under irradiation? And does it look like it's coming from like the direction that you've accelerated from? Or
yeah,
is it
so
beautiful?
So one of the things, when you accelerate like this, there's radiation, so let's imagine if I look, here's T, here's X, and here's a particle of constant acceleration. It in fact looks like a hyperboloid. In fact, that Cinch and Tosh are just the coordinates of a hyperboloid. Now, anything here can never communicate with you, right? It would have to travel faster than light, faster than this asymptote, in order to get from here into here. So this region in here is a hidden region. And this surface here, this asymptote, really looks like a horizon to you. Now, of course, you don't have to accelerate forever, in which case, of course, that horizon disappears. And you'll still see this thermal radiation during the time when you're accelerating. So it's not directly the horizon, but you know there are hints that there are something horizon-like about this radiation as well, this Hawking radiation.
Does that mean that you wouldn't see it as a uniform buff all around you? You would actually see photons coming from behind you?
No, but I mean, what happens, of course, is you're in this uniform gravitational field. Imagine a little particle, let's say, coming from the horizon. It rises up, but then, as with anything, it falls back down. Well, you see it going up, you also see it coming down, and it's got exactly the same velocity coming down as going up. So you see the same radiation coming from in front of you as is coming from behind you. And in fact, the radiation is essentially isotropic around you. I say essentially because there are some subtleties in there. it's isotropic in the detailed balance sense rather than isotropic in the strict literalist sense. So if you're a fundamentalist, then it's not isotropic. But as far as detailed balance is concerned, it is isotropic. Because of this stuff falls back down and hits you from the other side. Yes?
Well, if you, our spaceship can get accelerated by the apparent thermal radiation, can't you do that for a particle and accelerate?
Well, remember the buoyant force depends on the volume of the object, right? It's the weight of the displaced fluid. And the weight of the displaced fluid depends on how what the volume is of the thing. So for a single particle, you'd have to ask, what in the world is its volume? Does it actually exclude this fluid from itself or not? And for most particles, electrons and so forth, they're supposed to be point particles or something, they wouldn't exclude the fluid, and so they wouldn't feel this buoyant force. You can imagine that, let's say, you know, in the bag theory of nucleons that people were excited about at one point or another, where there was supposed to be this sort of skin around the nucleon, which did hold in the nuclei, that also holds out the stuff outside, maybe there would have been a little bit of this buoyant force in that case. But because of the buoyant force's dependence on volume, generically, no, you wouldn't see it. This preprint that we found, Periuchumenon by Archimedes, really fascinating paper. Bob Wald had the job of going, I mean, we sort of remembered having seen this this result beforehand, somewhere in grade 5 or something. But he had the job of chasing down this reference. And he phoned me one day and he said, I found it. There's, you know, this book. There's a translation by a guy named Heiberg. There's this book called Periuchumenon, which is on floating bodies. It's in two volumes, but just look at the first volume. The second one is too difficult. And I said, yeah, right. I'm a 20th century theoretical physicist, you know. I've got 2,000 years advantage on this guy. What are you talking about? Too difficult, right? So I went to the library, took out the book, started looking at them, started looking at the stuff. He was right. Archimedes was just absolutely brilliant. I mean, many of you probably have this image of him, you know, jumping out of his bath, running naked through the streets of Syracuse, shouting "Eureka!" And, you know, he sort of comes across as a bit of a fool or an idiot. He wasn't. He was a hell of a lot brighter than any of us are. He was doing things like calculating the equilibrium configuration of these sort of truncated paraboloids floating in water using purely geometrical methods, Euclidean geometrical methods. And, you know, trying to think about these problems in that kind of geometrical way is something that we've lost almost completely in our current algebraic way of thinking about mathematics. But that, you know, reading that book, incidentally, that book is the one also that a Greek copy, well, all of these books from that day, we have essentially none of them, because they all got destroyed somewhere along the line. And the only reason we get anything is because somebody thought it important enough to copy it and recopy it and recopy it. But we know that in the 13th century there were some copies, because there was a Latin translation made from a Greek copy of this book. But after that, one had no notion of the original Greek. Until Heiberg happened to be leafing through a catalog of some of the contents of the library at Santa Sofia in Istanbul, and came across this thing which was a palimpsest, which is where you take parchment, which is, you know, lambskin that they would write on, scrape it off the original stuff, and then write new stuff on. So somebody wanted to write this hymnal, he scraped off the original stuff and wrote, fortunately, perpendicular to the original writing, this hymnal. And Heiberg, you know, they had a little bit of the Greek that they could read, and he said, that looks a lot like Archimedes. And he took him about 2 years to get permission, and he went there, and sure enough, it was not only an original, well, original 13th, palimpsest had been made about the 13th century. So from that time of a Greek version of this Periuchomenon, but also a volume that nobody knew existed, that had disappeared from sight, nobody had translated it, called On Method, where Archimedes actually wrote and told how he did his mathematics, the thought processes he went through in order to develop his ideas. Heiberg then transcribed as much of it as he could, and then it disappeared again. And apparently during World War I, they closed the library and shipped a lot of their books to a more safe place, and in the process, at least one of the bags of books disappeared. That disappeared, so again, it had been lost. Then in about the 1980s, somebody started coming and saying they had this thing to sell, and they wanted, you know, lots of money for it, and nobody was willing to give them the money until finally in about 1996, an anonymous donor bought it. It had really got degenerated during the time, but people have been able, using, for example, the slack synchrotron, to, because there was iron in the ink that was used in the original, that they could then use it to differentiate. So they could again read. Also, some of the pages had been painted over to try and make it look more valuable. They put some illumination on four of the pages. They painted, you know, forged medieval illuminations on four of the pages. And so you have to try and read through all this painting, which they managed to do using these sort of iron fluorescence techniques. And one of the things that has been discovered is that, well, this one guy, Revel Metz in Stanford, feels very strongly that Archimedes actually understood the concept of infinity and sort of playing around with, you know, true limits and true sort of manipulations of infinite quantities, which is a very tricky thing to do, and he seemed to do it correctly. So that book has become a real sort of brother to me. I've never seen the actual volume. It's somewhere out east, and one day I'll have to go and see it. But, I mean, there's a book that Reverend Metz has written with one of the other curators describing the whole history of this palimpsest. And I, you know, read it. It's fun.
So, Bill, I know you have some time to talk.
Yes.
You have to get out to the
airport.
So, I don't know if you'd like to, if we should wrap up now. So,
thank you. Good luck.